Hello and welcome to Credit Shift News and Update. This week I'm Paul Sweeney, co-founder and chief strategy officer here at Webio, and today I am again joined by our CEO and co-founder, Cormac O'Neill.
Morning, Paul.
Good morning to you. And we will be again exploring some of the recent stories, events, reports, and trends in the credit industry. Cormac, before we kick off, any news from you from the week that's gone by?
No, not in really. Last week, Paul, after a few very eventful weeks, I think we had the Easter midterm break. So a lot of folks were off and on holidays and kids were home and all of that type of stuff. So I think what we're seeing now is just getting back to normal and business as usual for the next while till we kind of hit that summer rush. So all good, but no standout things from last week, Paul, to be honest. You know, I could make some stuff up maybe, but you know, let's not go there.
Nope, that's all good. All right, let's drive on. In general industry news, Thames Water, parent company, defaults on debt. This could be a significant event in that it could result in the restructuring or even the collapse of the company, according to some reporting. That's one to keep an eye on in the industry. In other news, Alliance Trade, in its latest report, found that for every 1% drop in profitability, it could increase payment terms by 7 days. So if a company is due to pay you a bill and it has a 1% drop in its profitability, it results in 7 further days of payments outstanding, drawing basically a clear line between profitability and ability to pay in companies. The third piece of industry news that obviously caught everyone's attention is that Visa Card and MasterCard have agreed to cut US transaction fees in a landmark settlement that merchants say will save them over $30 billion over 5 years. So swipe fees will go down, but also, and I think this is the interesting bit, merchants will be able to charge different prices to customers based on which credit card they use. Hmm. I think that last bit is a very interesting little piece of strategic news, Cormac, in that I think that when people get to checkouts or are choosing which way to pay, different fees might be able to be applied for different ways that you might want to pay.
Yeah, no, that's very good. I think the next logical step is making sure the consumers know which cards attract which fees, right? So they can make the right decisions to make sure that they're getting charged the minimum amount of fees. But that seems like a positive move in terms of fees coming down. That's certainly a bit of positive news there. I think the first two items you read out aren't. And they kind of tally with what I read in the Sunday papers. Well, here in Ireland anyway, and I'm sure it's probably the same in the UK, but there's an expectation that there's going to be quite a lot of failures, corporate failures, in the latter half of 2024. Now, a lot of it is in the SME sector that this is projected to happen, and a lot of it is down to do with supports that governments were given over COVID. They're long since gone now, but you got a number of things kicking in terms of tax warehousing and extra payments on tax debt, as well as rising inflation costs and all the rest. So it was a sober read, I have to say, at the weekend that's what the insolvency practitioners are expecting. You know, Thames Water, as we know from a previous life, is a great company. Lots of good people working there, doing a great service. So hopefully those guys will be able to do whatever restructuring is needed or whatever they need to do to get over this bit of a slump. And yeah, but look, I think it's just it could be a bumpy second half of the year for everything that we're reading about anyway. You know.
For sure, and I think the hospitality sector and the smaller companies in SMEs were particularly hard hit there.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Okay, moving on to our next section, Buy Now, Pay Later, AI and all things innovative technology. We do like to keep an eye on Klarna as the kind of bellwether in Buy Now, Pay Later. And new data from Klarna has highlighted that interest-free Buy Now, Pay Later offers consumers better outcomes when compared to traditional credit methods, with 95% of buy now, pay later purchases being paid off early or on time. The research says that 50% of credit card users miss monthly payments and incur interest. UK outstanding credit card debt increased by 9.2% in 2023, reaching an all-time high of almost 70 billion. With credit card interest rates at their highest in 27 years, consumers are paying more interest on higher debts. 60% of Klarna's buy now, pay later purchases were paid early, ahead of their due date, with 35% paid on the due date, and just 5% were late. Since launching late fees in the UK in March, Klarna has seen a noticeable drop in missed payments. Before implementing late fees, 12.55% of buy now, pay later transactions were late in Q4 2022. This rate dropped by 55% to 5.6% in Q3 2023. And 2023 overall, I believe 5.1% of buy now, pay later transactions incurred a late fee. So after sending a number of reminders over a four-month period, if payments still remain unpaid, Klarna passes debts over to an FCA-registered debt collect agency or collection agency. In Q1 in 2021, it was 1.9% of pay in three orders that were referred to a debt collection agency. In Q2 2023, this improved by 58% to 0.8% of orders. In 2023, just 0.61% of UK Klarna transactions were referred to an FCA approved debt collection agency. I think that's a really interesting kind of a data point there. It's interesting to see that Klarna referred to that as, I think they used a different term, but essentially it was not good revenue. So you shouldn't be making revenue from late payment fees. It's not a great revenue model. But using the fines really improved the late payment performance and kept people on schedule. So it's a great incentive. So a difficult one there for them. You know, you don't want to be collecting money from late fees. It's, as I said, it's not a great part of a revenue model, but it's proven to be very effective in keeping people on compliant with their payment plan. Interesting data.
Yeah, I suspect, Paul, that there's some good numbers in there. There's some really, really interesting ones for sure. But I suspect that the size of the purchases are at that level where, yeah, if you are incurring late fees as a percentage of the overall purchase, it's quite high. So that would certainly incentivize you not to incur those late fees and try and do everything you can to pay within your three installments or your 3 months. I'm actually surprised that 60% of customers are repaying early, if I'm hearing that correctly.
Yeah.
Ahead of time. That surprises me. I'm just trying to think of what the motivation would be to pay ahead early. I mean, if you're comfortable you can cover the three payments over 3 months and it's interest free, there doesn't seem to be any logic in paying early, unless that allows you to release further purchases. So, i.e., I want to buy another item which is at a higher value than the one I have. Therefore, if I pay, and I might be blocked from buying that item because I haven't repaid the first one. And therefore, if I repay the first one, I can buy the second one. It just logically, for an interest-free form of credit, there doesn't seem to be any logic in why you would pay that early. So I'm just trying to see what's behind the motivation there. You know,
a great example of seeing a number, but maybe there's something else behind the number. I think there's more emotion and behavioral stuff behind that than maybe logic. If perhaps you have another week, why would you not hold on to the tenner? But maybe you want to pay that £10 now and just have it done with. Like, it's just done.
Potentially.
It's, you know, it's not on my mind anymore. I know I've paid it. It's due next week, but I'm going to pay it now and not worry about it. I know.
Yeah. That could be the driver. The other one that's interesting is the amount of debt that's being passed on to DCAs. And it sounds like it's been declining quarter on quarter. that tells me that their internal process is pretty good.
Yeah.
That they've, you know, we've seen the example of the in-app conversational AI that they have. Potentially that's having an impact there. I don't know, but it seems to be pretty good. The level of debt that's getting passed over to DCAs. So yeah, they're, you know, I mean, I think they're pretty impressive.
We
numbers.
Have said this for some time though, Cormac, in that if you manage the early debt well, then naturally you have less late debt. So the example here is, you know, proactively manage all the customers and all your book and not let it get late before you kind of put formal processes in place.
Yeah. No, anyway, good job.
Moving on, I came across this great term during the week from Simon Taylor of Brain Food, just a newsletter I just absolutely love. He calls it Gen AI's software as a service era. And he's just had a few incredible lines last week. Let me just give you some quotes. LLMs raise the floor, not the ceiling. Then another one, circumstances matter. Reducing the data set to make them fit in a UI or API doesn't always work. And the third quote is, the gap is for bespoke, personalized offerings that can understand conditions and circumstances. Building a process or beautiful software is hard if the possible inputs or outputs are highly varied. And what was really interesting about just that first part of the quotes was, LLMs raise the floor, not the ceiling. It's basically saying that LLMs make us pretty damn good at a lot of different jobs if we can figure out how to use them. Like, you know, what do these numbers tell me? How could I resegment these customers? What kind of wording might work to be more convincing than this wording? And it makes us kind of a pretty good analyst at that kind of task. But it doesn't make us the best analyst. It doesn't raise the ceiling. If you're pretty good at your job, the LLM isn't going to make you a hell of a lot better at that job. So I really like that idea of it raises the floor, but not the ceiling at the moment. And I found the other point here. He says a few years ago, banks were giant software monoliths that were impossible to change. Then we entered the API era, and a wave of new services and providers entered the market. And Simon believes that we are entering another such era with Gen AI, and that it's probably only going to become more attractive as the capabilities of Gen AI grow. So just like your banking stack has changed from being a monolith to being, you know, much more available to APIs, much more API centric, and that was a huge shift for banks, a similar shift is going to come from general AI, and that there are particular circumstances where the Gen AI really plays a potential long-term role. And they're the areas where the inputs are variable and the outputs are variable. So they don't really lend themselves to a kind of very well-defined, very well, or as you would say, elegant and beautiful API solution. That kind of circumstance fits itself to a Gen AI solution. And I think this is the first time I've seen that kind of positioning of Gen AI as a layer being similar to kind of the API layer that happened over 10, 15 years. And I think it's the correct framing of it. And I just love Simon's framing of all things fintech. I'd strongly recommend people check out Brain Food as a newsletter.
Yeah, so I like that, Paul, in terms of, like, if we think about how we approach this from our own what we do and our own customers, like, we will always say to our customers, look, don't, when you're starting out using our AI and our machine learning tech, don't try to boil the ocean on this one, right? You know, start at that basic level, start with that cup of tea, and then move your way up into more sophisticated use cases for what you're doing with your AI. And I'm kind of attaching that to the raise the floor element of what he's talking about there. It's, look, take care of those basic things that you can really, you know, impact on straight away. And then as you get more comfortable with it, you can then start layering on top of that and building in more sophisticated solutions. And also, this is certainly something that we believe in a big way, in that we are very specialist in what we do. We're very focused on AI for credit and collections, and that's it, right? It's nothing else. We're not focused on any other use case right now. It's AI for credit and collections, and we know that space. We know the nuances. We know how those conversations happen, and what to expect in those conversations happen, you know. And I think that's kind of what he's getting at here in terms of and developing beautiful software is hard, right? You know, we know that for a fact, right? Developing, whether it's, I'm assuming when you say beautiful, you mean software that meaningfully impacts on its customers as opposed to pretty colors, right? So that's...
No, there's elegant design as well.
Elegant, yeah, okay, right. So as I always say, look, some of the best software out there, you don't even know it. It exists in your daily routine. It just does its job and gets on with it. So I think that focus on a specific area, a specific problem will yield high results. Highly variable approaches to this, and too broad and too wide is going to be difficult one, and you'll probably end up failing. So
it is interesting the way you put that, Cormac, and the different ways that people can say things in different languages and in different cultures, that they may not be direct linguistic transliterations, like just saying I am late, I will be there in a while. It just doing a straightforward translation of that may not transfer from one culture to another. So I think that there's an awful lot to be gained from just concentrating on a specific use case,
yeah,
and understanding the variability within that use case. Driving on, and there is a continuous theme from here on in, just on the general industry and AI, JP Morgan Chase & Company released their CEO Jamie Dimon's investment letter to shareholders, and it was focused on artificial intelligence, predicting that the tech will have sweeping changes in both business and society as a whole. Dimon compared the extraordinary consequences of AI to historic innovations like the printing press, electricity, steam engines, and computers. The CEO said the use of AI has the potential to augment virtually every job at the company. Dimon said that the firm had already grown its AI talent to over 2,000 experts and data scientists with over 400 AI ML use cases in production already. As the CEO of America's largest bank, Dimon's endorsement of AI's transformative potential carries significant weight in the industry. AI was the number one item on their section, update on specific issues facing our company. I thought this was really a moment, Cormac, for, you know, these, you know, banking, financial services, you know, some parts of it are very aggressive adopters of technology. Others are slower. And we'll go through some of that in a minute. But I think we're coming to the end of the beginning of adoption, in that people have had their pilots, they've had their test cases, and they're really now looking to push through into full production and really start getting benefits out of the technology. I think we've been through a period of exploration. But this really puts, I think the next 24 months are going to see a lot of banks push AI and Gen AI into production across their organization. And I think from what I've seen here, the focus on helping employees do their jobs is going to be very central to that. Everyone gets a co-pilot, as we say here in Webio.
So, look, first of all, I agree with what you said there in terms of what the was it the CEO? I can't remember who said this of the bank, that it's going to augment pretty much every job that's out there. Right. My only kind of like, you know, we've seen this before, Paul. Like, my only concern is that is some of this being driven by kind of like a fear of missing out or a fear of being left behind? Right. So if you're going to hire 2,000 odd people into your AI and your data area, that's great. Okay. You know, but have you got an absolute, and I'm sure they do, and I'm sure other banks have you got an absolute clear strategy as to what these folks are going to be working on and what they're going to be impacting on? And this isn't just like, you know, a knee-jerk reaction. I think you have to have a clear strategy. You know, where are we going with this? What do we want to achieve? What is it going to positively impact on? And then you can work towards delivering on that roadmap, as opposed to acting on everybody else is doing it, therefore we must do it. Well, and we've seen that before, whether it's in the internet age, whether it's in the mobile age. You know, I think that's my only thing. Listen to that course. We believe that AI is going to change a lot of things substantially. But it may take a little longer than people think.
I suspect you're right, Cormac. There was another comment from Simon at Brain Food during the week where he was saying that senior executives at the bank might be looking at these McKinsey cubes, where it's like, yeah, you know, enabling customer service on one cube and enabling document interrogation on another part of a cube. And it's like, okay, there's lots of things that we should be looking at, but it's still in, you know, it's still in this grid of possibilities. It's still all these potential use cases. And I think that we have seen before that the highest impacts are kind of end-to-end cases where you can completely automate a process that tends to have outsized effects. But end-to-end processes are really hard to automate. There's a lot of hidden connections and data requirements to make that happen. But let's push on. Let's look at some of the reports. This section three here, we try and pick out a report from the world of AI or finance and just bring it to your attention, and maybe it will be useful to you in your own strategic planning. And this week, we're looking at the highly regarded American publication, American Banker. And it has released a new report on AI adoption, and it hits some of the points you would expect it to hit if you were a regular listener to this podcast. So we're not going to go through all of them. But what struck me from reading the report was how foregrounded it was in the attitudes and understanding in relation to AI. For instance, how much bankers knew about AI, how much they knew specifically about Gen AI, and how did they feel about it? So while everyone thought, yes, it's going to make a big impact across the business, many still didn't really know the differences between traditional AI and the new Gen AI. Most had tried Gen AI through their experience with ChatGPT, but only 35% had used Bing AI, and something like 10% could name another Gen AI tool such as Anthropic's Claude. So they have the experience of using it personally, but again, it's pretty much being framed by their experience of ChatGPT, and nobody has really dug around and played with other alternatives. And that really tells me that OpenAI have grabbed a lot of brand in this market. What used to be IBM Watson, which was the only game in town a couple of years ago, all that's now OpenAI. So brand is playing a very big part here.
Yeah, absolutely. They've done a great job on that. I mean, you know, like Watson isn't even in the conversation.
No.
You know, and that, like, when we were starting out this journey, Paul, that was the conversation. And it's not even part of it now. So yeah, I totally agree with you on that one.
It also, just in terms of attitude, 61% felt that AI is evolving too quickly, but only 44% of those who are very familiar with AI felt it was evolving too quickly. So there's some attitudes around, again, You know, if it's changing too quickly, what do you do? Yeah. Do you wait? Do you play with it? You know, changing too
quickly. So I'm gonna challenge that, right? Because I'm not to 61% felt AI is evolving too quickly. You could flip that on its head and go to 61% aren't keeping up to speed quick enough with how it's evolving. You know, because if something is moving too fast and you're not able to keep up with it and you don't understand it, that automatically introduces fear into the equation. And, you know, if you don't understand something and you're not keeping up and you're asked a question, you're gonna go, this thing's evolving way too quickly, as opposed to I'm not keeping up with it quick enough to understand what's going on. So I think there's an element of that. And, you know, if we're honest about it, it is evolving really, really quickly. And even ourselves, we're, you know, running fast to try and keep up with what's happening. There's no doubt about that. So as opposed to it evolving too quickly, I think it may be people just aren't keeping up with what's going on.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that what the research is trying to get to here is that investment in AI is really also driven by how people react to the technology, what their experience of it, and that is reflected in their attitudes and beliefs. So if you're a senior person in a bank, in a large bank, and you have certain experiences or beliefs, that's going to affect how you direct that bank to adopt services. So just to quickly push on here, bankers tended to trust AI around rules-based processes and making recommendations based on established patterns of human activity. Interestingly, nearly half would trust AI to evaluate credit and loan applications for themselves and their families. But less than 9% would trust it to find caregivers to their children, elderly parents, or other family members. Only 9% would trust it to match you with a romantic partner, which I found a really strange statistic given that AI is driving all those matching services. So moving on to how they feel it would be to trust AI to be mostly or wholly responsible for any of the following in their business. Highest on that list are assisting employees with routine inquiries and assisting customers with routine inquiries at 72% and 69% respectively. Interestingly, only 27% would trust it to do to conduct direct customer conversations, so that's without a human in the loop, and only 11% would trust it in recruiting and hiring. Again, it's interesting to see that there's something process-based, it's can be over, and it can be overseen by a real human. It tends to be trusted to a higher degree, but where it seems it's something that really would need human evaluation, something to do with relationship or intimacy, those kind of jobs, there's a low trust in an AI solution, and probably rightly so. This seems to be tied to concerns that AI is AI and excessive automation might result in a loss of personal touch with customers and clients. And that was the highest reason cited at 70%, with the next highest reason being that AI might introduce some sort of ethical concern or bias in the interaction. So again, how you adopt and what you trust the AI to do, if it's rules-based or it's historical behavior-based, you might trust it a little bit more. As a banker, again, all this is as a banker, very much trusted to impact and that kind of co-pilot for employee, co-pilot for a customer, but very low trust for it to do very human, how do I evaluate you as a person type behaviors, which is probably, given the kind of things we've seen in the past of bias, is very true. And again, the bigger banks are taking the lead here. But they have more resources. 35% of them are taking an incremental approach of the bigger banks, starting with small pilot projects. Nearly 50% of them taking an approach that's either incremental or small specific task or specific function implementation. So at least half of the big banks kind of moving from incremental into more aggressive stances of adoption. And this makes sense because they have more resources. So the bigger the bank, the more likely they are to really dive into this. And I think these numbers reflect the fact that I've also seen from the world of conversational AI and Gen AI, in that many of the projects in this space have tended to be pegged at the 1 million to 1.5 million mark, kind of the proof of concept level for these big banks. So my big takeaway is that banks are still concerned that Gen AI produces hallucinations, that it contains biases, and that you have to be able to explain, you know, down to every level exactly how an algorithm is performing, why it's making decisions, how it can be trusted, and that whole kind of ethical AI approach really needs to be front and center for the banks to really jump in here. So a big report, a big letter from Jamie Dimon. Again, just as a kind of ending comment here, I think we're on the cusp of seeing the industry move now from proof of concepts, pilots, etc. I think we're moving from there now into the kind of production end of implementations. Cormac, any insights from you from that?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with you on that last comment on that, Paul. I guess some of the findings in the report you would kind of see yourself nodding your head with in terms of trust around health and home caring or caring issues. You know, obviously we're all super sensitive around our health and our loved ones. So, you know, we're going to have to it's early days for AI. It's early days, and it's going to take time to build trust for us in those areas. I mean, you know, for automating some of the everyday stuff that we do that, you know, not going to say it doesn't really matter, but it doesn't impact on our health. Yeah, look, that's fine. But once it gets to that side of it, it's, you know, you're going to see a serious drop in those statistics. And again, I think the loss of the human touch and the personal touch is always going to be there, depending on what the use case is. Again, until we get more comfortable with how good AI is and what it can do, you're always, you know, you always miss. That's why us Irish go to the pub so often, right? We want to have that human touch, you know. Can you imagine having a virtual pint in a virtual bar talking to it? Well, I just can't see it, you know.
I think, Cormac, it's just occurred to me as you were talking there that I disagree with you.
And I again, Paul, you're, I know, again. Yeah, I know. This is terrible.
It's good. It's good to have different opinions. But I think I remember back to the banks saying, there's no way people are going to do all their banking online because they love coming into the bank and meeting our tellers, and that exchange was important, and them knowing you from your weekly visits was an important part of banking, and therefore that branch banking would always be with us. And that just wasn't the case. And I remember another case where someone was saying, oh, we really want our agents to be speaking to the customers because it builds that relationship. And there's just one example of someone who went into it and they were looking at why the customer was being spoken to for such, you know, conversationally with the agent. And it was because the agent was pulling up different screens. They actually weren't able to get the answer to that customer. Like if you ask the customer, how was your week? You know, what's the weather like where you are? And the customer talks for a minute. That gave them time to actually pull up the information from other screens so they could get the answer back to that customer. So it was a filler. And it just, again, I think people overestimate the services that require, face-to-face human interaction to fulfill a service. I think it's been consistently overweighted.
What I said there was until people get comfortable with it, right? Until they get completely comfortable with it. So if you take the banking example that you use there, it took people time to get comfortable with using their apps and using their online banking before you got, let's call it, a tipping point. And we still have branches up and down the country, you know, bank branches up and down the country. Now, they may be providing different services and more high value added services, more like giving out, you know, mortgages or investment advice more so than current banking, current account banking, so to speak. So it's reflected in the stats you read out there in terms of that loss of personal touch. And until people get comfortable with AI and what it can do over time, you'll see those stats to improve. You know, for sure. But hey, we still have high street banks. We still have tellers. We still have, they're still there, man. They're still there.
I was only in a bank last week, Cormac. Anyway, look, that's very interesting. Again, I hope that this brings our listeners some access to data that's interesting to their own businesses, that you guys can look into the show notes here to find the reports and articles that we refer to. We're always open to other ideas. So if you have ideas of what you'd like to see covered in Credit Shift, hey, reach out to us. Let us know. We'd love to know. Until next week, I will bid you farewell. Cormac.
Have a good week, folks.